So he had a very close feeling about the spiritual, and he felt that it should be the center of the United Nations.
Where would he find it?
He had a special crew of painters working on the meditation room that evening. He said, "We want to bring back in this room the stillness which we have lost in our streets and in our conference rooms, and to bring it back in a setting in which no noise would impinge on our imagination."
On a lighter note, Hounschild also held some positive views on the subject of holding concerts in the halls of the United Nations. Could you explain?
Yes, Dag Hammarskjöld believed that international understanding had to be built on a much broader base than just political accord. It needed mutual appreciation of the cultures, the art, the literature, and music of the world. As a consequence, he introduced concerts in the General Assembly Hall for special occasions. Concerts by the leading orchestras of the world and the leading soloists. And he once told me that when he decided to introduce concerts into the UN, someone said this was, said that, someone said that Trygve Lie had remarked that this was profaning the Parliament of Man. Hammarskjöld responded, I'm told, that if this was profanity, he was prepared to make the most of it.
In 1960, the United Nations embarked on its largest peacekeeping operation in the former Belgian Congo, during the course of which Dag Hammarskjöld was to lose his life. You have already dealt in part in our earlier interview with the trouble between Hammarskjöld and the USSR over the Congo operation. Could you tell us in brief outline some of the events that led Hammarskjöld to fly to the Congo in September 1961 and what happened as a result?
To begin with, on the July night in 1960, when the Democratic National Convention was nominating John F. Kennedy as its presidential candidate in Los Angeles, the UN Security Council was meeting in crisis session here in New York. For the first time, a Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld, had invoked Article 99 of the UN Charter. This authorizes the Secretary General to call the Council's attention to any matter he decides threatens international peace. Otherwise, of course, Council sessions are usually requested by governments. Dag Hammarskjöld had asked for UN military assistance for the new Republic of the Congo because Belgium had sent troops back into its former African colony and bloodshed was mounting. The political roll call in Los Angeles was interrupted from time to time that night by the radio and television networks for reports on the Council proceedings before dawn. Secretary General, Before dawn, the Secretary General was authorized by the Council to create the UN's largest peacekeeping force to be recruited from small nations outside the cold warring camps of the big powers. This was largely because of the fact that the big powers were competing for influence in the Congo. The contingent eventually that went to the Congo numbered over 23,000 men, cost $360 million, lasted 3.5 years, and Dag Hammarskjöld was among the casualties. The climax approached in the fall of 1961, just before the meeting of the General Assembly. Dag Hammarskjöld decided to fly back to the Congo 3 days before the assembly opened in 1961 in the hope that once more he could persuade Tshombe, who was then holding on to the rich Katanga province of the Congo, to bring Katanga back into the Congo and thus help to reunite the country.
The news of Hammarskjöld's death in Rhodesia began to reach New York in the early hours of Sunday, 17 September 1961. What do you remember of that terrible day?
That was 2 days before the opening of the General Assembly, and NBC put on a special broadcast on television that night about the issues that were coming up in the coming assembly. As a matter of fact, I said in that broadcast that Dag Hammarskjöld would be destroyed. I meant, of course, that he would not be permitted by the Soviet Union to have another term of office. But little did I know that probably about that moment his plane was coming, was being downed, whether by accident or by intent. It's still not clear. Nevertheless, the next morning, about 6 o'clock, I was called by NBC to get to the UN because Dag Hammarskjöld's plane was missing. That morning I was at the UN before Andy Cordier or many of the other UN people. And then came hours of waiting and waiting and waiting for some word as to the plane and as to the fate of Dag Hammarskjöld. About noon, there was no longer any opportunity to wait because the news came in that he was dead. The plane had been downed, whether by, well, I've already said that. The plane had been brought down. And then followed investigations to determine how the accident had occurred, whether it was an accident or by intent, and nothing has ever been definite as far as the investigations are concerned. Nations as memorial services were held, and everyone was wondering what was going to happen next with Dag Hammarskjöld gone. The atmosphere at the United Nations was very gloomy as everyone wondered what was going to happen to the UN itself with Dag Hammarskjöld gone.
That Sunday evening, you wound up your full day of broadcasting with an eloquent personal statement, obviously from the heart. It is a memorable bit of television commentary and history, and I would be most grateful if you would first read it for us and then make any comments you might have 25 years later.
Secretary General Hammarskjöld is said to have had one regret about the big power crisis. The Soviet Union's break in relations with him had denied him any opportunity to do something. Hammarskjöld is a hostage of the Cold War. So is the United Nations. This is a time of year when delegates of 99 nations pay lip service to a guilty conscience. In the midst of the greatest war preparation in history, the annual pilgrimage here is underway in remembrance of a pledge once taken to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. While rocket plants hum and armies, navies, and air forces play their games, men will be going to the rostrum in the assembly hall below this booth to repeat the old cliches about ending man's inhumanity to man. But it appears to be easier to build a rocket and explore space than to explore the minds of men for the common ground on which to try to cultivate understanding that might prevent the final incineration. The United Nations is only one idea, that the conference table should be substituted for the battlefield. It becomes reality only if the members so choose. Instead, they have chosen to make it a banner under which to fight cold wars, big and little. Defeating a political enemy has been more important than defeating the common enemy, war. Saving face has interfered with trying to save succeeding generations. Hammarskjöld's greatest fault is his dedication to finding the answer to what he believes is man's greatest prayer, which asks not for victory, but for peace. In a day when victory is still the goal, even though there can be no victory, this peacemaker will be sacrificed. And so will the United Nations on the altar of military might, until there is acceptance by all that salvation in the nuclear age lies on the conference table, not on the battlefield, that this is the first resort of men of reasons, that this is the first resort of men of reason, not the last as it now is, that in conciliation, mediation, and arbitration, there is common strength, not individual weakness. Perhaps the trouble with the United Nations is that the people have deserted its ideal. Perhaps the trouble with the United Nations is that the people have deserted this ideal, which is too important to leave to the diplomats. The Charter is a covenant entered into by peoples, not governments.